This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Julian Ng with Wong Xiaoneng and Sharad Abdullah. Now, it is widely believed that China is using the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, to spread its influence around the world. However, mounting geopolitical concerns could shave off $800 billion of potential investments worth some $1.3 trillion, according to some of the more optimistic projections.
And this is coming from a report from the consultancy Silk and Road Associates and law firm Baker McKinsey. So moving forward, I think the report also outlined five scenarios for future BRI investment by China. So there were five out of the five. They are the more optimistic ones and pessimistic ones as well. These are the scenarios which could impact significantly about $800 billion investment by China. So the more optimistic one is the global cooperation model could see China spend about $1.3 trillion globally between 2020 to 2030. And the pessimistic scenario, a unipolar situation, sees China investing only about $560 billion.
And now we turn to Ben Simpfendorfer, CEO of Silk Road Associates and the author of the report, for more insights. Based on the current trajectory of developments, the baseline scenario sees investment value of up to $910 billion. But his other potential outcomes could vary between $560 billion all the way to $1.3 trillion. What is the most important development that will determine those outcomes?
The U.S.-China trade war is perhaps among the most important, and the trade war is forcing change in the supply chain. Global brand owners are beginning to source more product from other low-cost countries because of or in response to the increase in U.S. tariffs on imports from China. Most of their sort of sourcing decisions are focused on Bangladesh and Vietnam, but we're starting to see movement into other countries in Southeast Asia in particular, such as Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. Chinese manufacturers are also beginning to respond, and they've been reluctant to respond to rising prices at home for some time now. But the U.S.-China trade war has really forced upon them a decision. And that decision is to begin to invest into capacity in other parts of the world, but again, particularly into Southeast Asia. And that all is very supportive of Belt and Road because it makes many of these large infrastructure projects, whether that's road, rail, or ports, more commercially viable because as we begin to see sort of export production out of all of these countries begin to increase, then naturally they have to use some of the infrastructure that was built as a result of the Belt and Road.
You mentioned that Chinese manufacturers are beginning to branch out of China more, but what will affect this hypothesis?
There is always the risk of growing nationalism, and certain countries around the region will have their own priorities and policies, and their preference. And as a result of that, we may see Chinese manufacturers investing in only a handful of countries, especially those in Southeast Asia. They may perhaps struggle to go to other places. But again, what I'd emphasize here is that there is a clear difference between large-scale infrastructure projects, which are funded and built by Chinese SOEs, and China's private sector, especially manufacturers, who are really investing on the basis of profit, are more likely to engage in alliances or joint venture arrangements with local parties. And so they're less subject to government priorities or nationalist trends. They simply go where there is opportunity. So I guess the greatest risk from rising nationalism to the Belt and Road Initiative would be specific to those big ticket infrastructure projects, the big high speed rail or standard gauge rail projects, as an example.
What is China already doing to build more support for the BRI, and what do you think it should be doing moving forward?
China has recognized the importance of collaboration. The early Belt and Road projects were often characterized as China-only projects. They were China-funded, China-built, even China-operated at times. There's a growing recognition that that's no longer sustainable, especially, again, in Southeast Asia. China has reached out to Japan to seek greater collaboration, and we're seeing evidence of that in Thailand, especially the Eastern Economic Corridor, where Japanese companies are very active. China and Japan held a joint seminar last year on exactly this subject, looking for collaborative opportunities. And so we'd expect to see that type of collaboration begin to grow over time. We also would expect to see Chinese firms increasingly look for opportunities in clean energy, where there is clearly a push among a range of actors, from governments to multilateral development banks, to even the private sector, to invest into clean energy, especially solar and wind power. And there we see significant opportunities in India, as an example, where the government is clearly seeking to grow the amount of power produced by clean energy, and Chinese private sector could be playing a role here and an important role over time.
That was Ben Simpson Dorfer, CEO of Silk Road Associates on the BRI. I think that it is clear that this can be a carrot or a stick, as we've seen in countries like Sri Lanka, who couldn't service its debt after the port or whatever infrastructure was built and found themselves having to return that asset to China, lease it to China over some years. And therefore losing a very important strategic asset of the country. Malaysia also went through some renegotiation of the ECRL plus a suspension of other projects in the pipeline with China due to cost issues. And ECRL was itself reduced to quite substantially from a cost perspective.
But the Chinese government is aware of the optics of it, and which is why at the recent BRI conference, their tone was more conciliatory. And also the types of projects and the size of the projects has been somewhat scaled down. And there's a little bit more towards environmental friendly projects, as opposed to last time where it was mass highways or very big trains. Yeah. So I think this BRI is a constantly evolving thing. So whatever the estimates, whether it's 880 million or 1.3 trillion US dollars, I think that will just constantly change.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, the reputation here has to be prepared. Like you mentioned, I think it's making it a bit greener, scaling it down. But at the same time, I think when it first came out, because it's this big amount of money, it was probably mouth-watering for a lot of government. And I think that's why one of the things that they plan to do to repair the reputation is also, I think, trying to stem down on the, stemming down the possible possible opportunity of corruption because governments see this as a very big a money project. So we saw our train scaled down to up to about 40 billion in comparison to the over 70 billion. But at the same time, I think it has, there seemed to be an agreement that this should be, this should continue because Asia basically needs a lot of infrastructure to sort of develop the emerging market, about $26 trillion worth. That's how much we're going to need.
Yeah, with or without China, $26 trillion is needed for those kind of infrastructure. And I guess the question is, what does it mean from the person on the street? The usual belief is that this kind of project usually creates a kind of multiplier effect for the growth of the economy. But that there is a big corruption component in this kind of thing. Then we have things like base effects, profit shifting, right? The escape of taxes by a lot of these huge multinationals that undertake those infrastructure projects. The question then becomes how much of this kind of benefits reach the ordinary person on the street.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.